A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
My Weird Prompts is a community-driven initiative exploring how AI can fuel curiosity and uncover the fascinating ways our world works. GPU compute for this podcast is generously provided by Modal. Learn more at modal.com.
Imagine it is September 26, 1983. A high-altitude bunker outside Moscow, known as Serpukhov 15, is buzzing with the low-frequency hum of Soviet early warning systems. The atmosphere is thick with the smell of ozone and stale coffee. Suddenly, the screens turn blood red. A single word flashes in Cyrillic, launch, then another, then five. The system is reporting that the United States has launched 5 Minuteman intercontinental ballistic missiles toward the Soviet Union. The protocol is clear. The decision framework is rigid. If the system detects a launch, you report it up the chain, and the inevitable counterstrike begins. This is the height of the Cold War. Tensions are at a breaking point. But the man in the chair, Lieutenant Colonel Stanislav Petrov, hesitates. He looks at the data, looks at the rigid logic of the machine, and he senses something is wrong. Why only 5 missiles? A first strike should be a massive wave. He decides to ignore the framework. He calls it a false alarm. He survives the night, and because of that one moment of human intuition overriding a technical model, so does the rest of the world.
That is one of the most chilling examples of what we call the decision paradox. We live in an era where we have more data, more sensors, and more computational power than at any point in human history, yet high-stakes choices feel more volatile and dangerous than ever. I am Herman Poppleberry, and I have spent the last few days buried in papers about how we have tried to formalize that moment of hesitation, how we have tried to build a computational architecture for the human gut. Today's prompt from Daniel is a massive one. It is about decision-making frameworks, ranging from the technical math of Bayesian networks to the simple lists we use to decide what to have for dinner. It is essentially the history of how we try to be less wrong in a world that is increasingly complex and ambiguous.
It is funny you start with Petrov, because it highlights that we create these frameworks specifically, so we do not have to rely on a single guy in a bunker having a good day or a bad day. We want objectivity. We want a system that works the same way every time. Yet, in the highest stakes imaginable, the framework was the thing that almost killed us, because it could not account for a rare atmospheric reflection off high-altitude clouds, which is what actually triggered those sensors. Daniel's prompt covers the whole decision stack. We are talking about the evolution, from static lists to dynamic, AI-augmented systems. We did an episode a while back, episode 816, about the evolution of human order, from scrolls to databases. This feels like the logical next step. Once you've organized the world into a database, how do you actually decide what to do with all that information? Are we gaining the tools to handle this complexity, or are we just outsourcing our agency to algorithms we do not fully understand?
That is the central question of 2026. The transition from static frameworks to dynamic systems is where the real story lives. For centuries, decision-making was seen as either divine will throwing lots or reading tea leaves, or pure, unteachable intuition. It was not until the Enlightenment that we started trying to map out the math of choice. We started with what is known as expected utility theory, or EUT. The idea was deceptively simple. If you have a set of choices, you multiply the probability of an outcome by the value, or utility, of that outcome. Whichever number is higher is the rational choice. If there is a 10% chance of winning $100, the expected utility is $10. If there is a 50% chance of winning $15, the expected utility is $7.50. You take the first bet.
That sounds great on a chalkboard, but it assumes humans are these perfectly rational, spherical calculators in a vacuum. We know that is not true. If I offer you a 50% chance to win $100 or a guaranteed $45, most people take the 45. The math says the 50% chance is worth $50, which is more, but the human brain hates the risk of getting zero. We are not expected utility machines. We are loss aversion machines.
That is where Daniel Bernoulli stepped in with the St. Petersburg paradox. He realized that the marginal utility of money decreases as you get more of it. $1,000 to a billionaire is just statistical noise. $1,000 to a college student is life-changing. So the framework had to evolve to account for psychological utility, not just raw value. But even that was too simple. It did not account for how we actually process complex, multi-layered problems where there is no single right answer and where the variables are not all in the same currency. How do you compare the utility of a shorter commute versus the utility of a better school district for your kids?
That is where something like the analytic hierarchy process, or AHP, comes in. I remember you talking about Thomas Sauty before. He developed this in the 1970s to handle decisions that have a dozen different variables that do not speak the same language. It is a way of decomposing a massive, terrifying problem into a series of small, manageable comparisons. How do you compare the cost of a new city bridge with the environmental impact on a local bird species and the political optics of the mayor's re-election? You cannot just multiply those numbers together.
Sati's insight was brilliant because it acknowledged that humans are actually terrible at absolute scale, but great at relative comparison. If I ask you how many tons a bridge weighs, you have no idea. But if I show you two bridges, you can probably tell me which one looks heavier. The AHP breaks a decision into a hierarchy. At the top is your ultimate goal. Below that are your criteria cost, environment, politics. Below those are your alternatives. Plan A, Plan B, or Plan C. You then do pairwise comparisons for every single element.
So you are basically sitting in a room and saying, between cost and environment, which is more important to me right now? And you use a scale, right?
Yes. Usually a scale of 1 to 9. Once you fill out these comparison matrices, the math uses eigenvectors, which are a way of finding the core direction of the data, to calculate the specific weight of each factor. What I love about AHP is that it flushes out your inconsistencies. If you say cost is more important than environment, and environment is more important than politics, but then you say politics is more important than cost, the AHP framework catches that. It calculates a consistency ratio. If your ratio is too high, the model basically tells you that you're lying to yourself or that you do not actually know what you want. It forces a level of logical rigor that our brains usually skip over in favor of whichever criteria is shouting the loudest in our heads at that moment.
It is a truth serum for your own priorities, but let's look at the more technical side that Daniel mentioned, Bayesian decision networks. This feels like the modern AI-adjacent approach. It is not just about comparing weights. It is about updating your entire worldview in real time as new data comes in. This isn't just a list. It's a living map.
Bayesian networks are the gold standard for decision-making under uncertainty, especially as we move into this era of massive data streams. It goes back to Reverend Thomas Bayes and his theorem on conditional probability. The core idea is that you have a prior belief about the world. Then you see new evidence. You do not just throw away your old belief, you update it based on the strength of the new evidence to get a posterior belief. In a decision network, you have nodes representing variables and arrows representing dependencies. If we are deciding whether to launch a new product, one node might be market demand, another might be competitor response, and another might be production cost.
And these nodes are not just yes or no switches, they are probability distributions. It is not, will the competitor react, but what is the probability they react with a price cut versus a new feature?
And when you change one node, say, you get a report that the competitor just hired a new CEO. The probabilities ripple through the entire network. This is how modern medical diagnostics work, which we discussed in episode 870. An AI does not just look at a cough and say, flu. It looks at the symptom, updates the probability based on the time of year, looks at a lab result, updates it again, and then tells the doctor the most likely path forward. It is a formal way of doing what a seasoned detective or a master physician does, but it does it with mathematical precision and without the recency bias that often plagues humans.
It strikes me, though, that these frameworks are often used to justify decisions that have already been made. There is a cynical side to this, where a committee uses a complex model like multi-criteria decision analysis, or MCDA, just to give a veneer of objectivity to a purely political choice. They tweak the weights until the model says what they wanted it to say from the beginning. But when we look at something like the military, they cannot afford that kind of theater. They take this stuff incredibly seriously because the feedback loop is often measured in lives lost.
The military application of these frameworks is where the decision stack gets very real. They use something called the military decision making process, or MDMP. It is a 7-step cycle that is drilled into officers. It starts with the receipt of the mission and goes all the way through orders production. But the heart of it is course of action, or COA, development. They do not just pick one plan. They are required to develop multiple distinct plans. Plan A cannot just be Plan B with more tanks. They have to be fundamentally different approaches. Then they put them through a wargaming process.
This is where we get into the red teaming we discussed in episode 893. You cannot just have a framework for your own logic. You need a framework for how your logic will fail when an adversary hits it. You need someone whose entire job is to be the anti-framework.
Wargaming is essentially a manual Monte Carlo simulation. For those who do not know, Monte Carlo simulations were formalized during the Manhattan Project in the 1940s by Stanislaw Ulam and Nicholas Metropoulos. They were trying to understand neutron diffusion, which is incredibly random and complex. You cannot solve it with a simple equation. So, they ran the model thousands of times with slightly different random variables to see the range of possible outcomes. The military does this now with humans and computers. They want to know not just what is likely to happen, but what is the left tail risk, the low probability, high impact disaster.
It is a deep irony that the Manhattan Project gave us both the ultimate weapon and one of the most powerful tools for deciding how to use it. But let's bring this down to earth. Most of our listeners are not planning a land invasion or modeling neutron stars. They are trying to decide whether to quit their job, buy a house, or invest in a new technology. Daniel mentioned simpler frameworks like the Eisenhower Matrix or SWOT analysis. Do these actually provide rigor, or are they just glorified to-do lists for people who want to feel productive?
They serve a different purpose, cognitive offloading. Our brains have a limited working memory. When we are stressed, that memory shrinks. The Eisenhower Matrix, which separates tasks into urgent versus important, is about resource allocation. It is a 2x2 grid. Most people spend their lives in the urgent but not important quadrant, answering pings and emails that do not actually move the needle. The framework forces you to see that visually. It is a simple heuristic, a SWOT analysis. Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats is a qualitative version of the AHP. It does not give you a number, but it forces you to look at the external environment and internal capabilities simultaneously.
I find that SWOT is often where people lie to themselves the most, though. They list their strengths and then treat their weaknesses as just areas for growth. It lacks the teeth of a Bayesian network. But maybe that is the point. Sometimes you just need a mirror to see what you are already thinking. However, I worry about the data overload fallacy. We think that if we just add more rows to the spreadsheet, or more variables to the model, the right answer will eventually pop out.
That is a huge misconception. More data does not always lead to a better decision. Often, it just leads to more confidence in a bad decision. This is where the human-in-the-loop necessity comes back in. AI systems are prone to what we might call algorithmic myopia. They are excellent at optimizing for the data they have been given, but they cannot account for things that are not in the dataset. They cannot account for a sudden shift in human values or a black swan event that has no historical precedent. We are seeing AI-driven decision systems in finance that can execute trades in milliseconds, but they can also cause flash crashes because they are all following the same underlying logic.
That is a great point. If everyone is using the same Bayesian model, you lose the diversity of thought that makes a market or a society resilient. It becomes a monoculture of logic. I want to touch on the political side of this for a moment, because decision frameworks in government are often where the rubber meets the road. In the conservative worldview, there is often a healthy skepticism of these massive centralized planning models. The idea is that the world is too complex for a group of bureaucrats in a room to model correctly.
That is the Hayekian view of dispersed knowledge. Friedrich Hayek argued that the information required to make complex social decisions is scattered among millions of individuals in the form of local, tacit knowledge. No single framework can capture it all. This is why markets are often better decision-making engines than committees. A market is essentially a massive, decentralized Monte Carlo simulation happening in real time. Every transaction is a data point. When a government tries to impose a rigid decision framework on an economy, they often fail because they lack that local sensing capability.
It is the difference between a top-down model and a bottom-up emergence. We see this in geopolitical strategy, too. A strong leader often has to make a decision that flies in the face of what the bureaucratic models suggest. Look at the decision to move the United States Embassy to Jerusalem. For decades, the foreign policy establishment had frameworks and models suggesting this would lead to immediate, widespread regional collapse. The model said it was a non-starter. But the decision was made based on a different set of priorities, sovereignty, promises kept, and a different read on the regional dynamics, and the dire predictions of the models did not materialize.
That is a perfect example of where the model becomes a cage. If your framework only includes the variables that have been true for the last 40 years, it cannot account for a paradigm shift. The model becomes a way to justify the status quo rather than a tool for discovery. This is why red teaming and adversarial thinking are so important. You have to actively try to break your own model. In the current administration, we see a preference for clarity and strength over the endless, on the one hand, on the other hand, style of decision-making that you often see in academia. It is about identifying the core objective and moving toward it, rather than getting paralyzed by a multi-criteria decision analysis that has 55 different variables.
There is a cost to complexity. Every variable you add to a decision framework is a potential point of failure. It is also a way to hide accountability. If a decision is based on a massive, opaque model, no one is responsible when it goes wrong. They just say the model was off. But in a more traditional, leadership-driven framework, the person at the top owns the outcome. That clarity is actually a form of rigor itself. It is a different kind of framework, one based on responsibility rather than just probability.
So where does that leave the modern professional? We're being told to be data-driven, to use AI, to be objective. But we are also seeing that the most successful decisions often come from people who know when to ignore the dashboard. The goal should be to use the framework to inform your intuition, not to replace it. Think of it like a pilot using an autopilot system. The autopilot handles the routine complexity, the millions of tiny adjustments needed to keep the plane level. That frees up the pilot to focus on the big picture, the weather patterns, and the emergency scenarios. You want a framework that handles the heavy lifting of data synthesis and bias checking, but you want to keep your hand on the yoke.
I like that. The framework is the exoskeleton, not the brain. It makes you stronger and more stable, but you still have to decide where to walk. Let's talk about the practical side for our listeners. If someone is facing a big decision right now, maybe a career change or a major investment, what is the most effective way to use these tools without getting lost in the weeds?
I would suggest starting with a pre-mortem. This is a technique developed by psychologist Gary Klein. Instead of looking forward and asking what might happen, you imagine it is a year from now and the decision has been a total disaster. You then work backward to figure out why it failed. This bypasses our natural optimism bias. It forces your brain to look for the flaws in your logic that your expected utility model might be ignoring. It is a simple, non-technical way to get the benefits of a red teaming exercise.
I love the pre-mortem. It is so much more effective than a pros and cons list because it forces you to tell a story. Humans are much better at narrative than we are at lists. If I can tell a convincing story about why I went broke after starting a business, I am much more likely to see the risks I am ignoring today. It turns the unknown unknowns into known unknowns.
Once you have done the pre-mortem, then you can bring in the more structured tools. Use a simple version of the analytic hierarchy process. Pick your top four criteria. For a job, it might be salary, work-life balance, career growth, and location. Compare them in pairs. You might find that you have been telling yourself salary is most important, but when you compare it directly to work-life balance, you realize you value your time more. The framework acts as a truth serum for your own priorities.
And then, if you really want to go deep, you can look at the Bayesian side of things. Ask yourself, what piece of information would actually change my mind? If I am convinced this is the right move, what evidence would prove me wrong? If I find out the company is losing money, does that change the probability of success by 10% or 50%? It makes you thinking more granular. It stops you from treating a decision like a coin flip.
That granularity is what prevents the all or nothing thinking that leads to catastrophic mistakes. Most people treat a decision like a binary switch, but it is usually more like a weather forecast. You are not looking for a certainty, you are looking for an edge. AI is getting very good at helping us find that edge by processing the massive amounts of noise that surround every major choice. We are seeing the rise of decision-as-a-service platforms, where you can plug in your data and your values, and the system spits out the optimal path.
But the noise is also where the human element lives. I am thinking about the medical field again. We have these incredible diagnostic models that can spot a tumor on a scan better than a radiologist. But the decision of how to treat that patient, how to talk to their family, how to balance the quality of life against the length of life, that is a multi-criteria decision that an AI cannot truly handle because it involves values, not just data. Values are the weights in the AHP. An AI can tell you the probability of a treatment working, but it cannot tell you how much you should value a month of pain-free life versus a year of difficult treatment. That is the human part of the hierarchy.
We have to provide the values. The frameworks just help us apply those values consistently, but I worry that we will lose the muscle memory of making hard choices. If you always follow the model, what happens when the model is wrong and you have forgotten how to trust your gut? We see it already with GPS. People have lost the ability to navigate their own cities because they just follow the blue line. If we do that with our lives, if we just follow the blue line of a decision framework, we become spectators in our own stories. The framework should be tools for exploration, not scripts for living.
I think that is a perfect place to start wrapping this up. We've gone from Soviet bunkers and the Manhattan Project to the Eisenhower Matrix and AI-driven diagnostics. The common thread is this persistent human desire to bring order to chaos. We want to believe that if we just find the right math, we can eliminate the pain of uncertainty. But, as we saw with Stanislav Petrov, sometimes the most important decision-making framework is the one that tells you when to stop listening to the machine.
Uncertainty is not a bug. It is a feature of the world. If every decision were perfectly calculable, there would be no room for leadership, no room for courage, and no room for the kind of world-changing moves that defy the models. The frameworks are there to help us clear the fog, but we still have to be the ones to step into the unknown. The goal is not to be right every time. That is impossible. The goal is to be less wrong over time by building a better architecture for our choices.
Well said. I think we have given people plenty to chew on. Before we sign off, I want to reiterate that point about the pre-mortem. If you are listening to this and you have a big choice looming, whether it is personal, professional, or even political, take 10 minutes today. Imagine it failed. Write down why. It is the cheapest, most effective decision framework you will ever use. It forces you to confront the black swans before they land on your doorstep.
It really is. And for those who want to dive deeper into the technical side, there are some incredible open source tools for Bayesian networks and AHP that you can play with. It is a fascinating world once you start seeing the underlying logic of how we choose. Just remember, use the model to inform your gut, not to silence it.
This has been a deep dive, and honestly, I feel a little more equipped to handle my own decision making, or at least to know which framework I am ignoring when I decide what to have for dinner. Thanks as always to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the gears turning behind the scenes and ensuring our own decision-making process for the show remains somewhat rigorous.
And a big thanks to Modal for providing the GPU credits that power the AI components of this show. Their infrastructure makes it possible for us to explore these complex topics with the depth they deserve, especially as we look at how machine learning is changing the decision stack in early 2026.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this exploration of the math and mystery of choice, consider leaving us a review on your favorite podcast app. It really does help other people find the show and join the conversation about how we navigate this complex world.
We will be back next time with another prompt from Daniel. Until then, keep questioning the models, keep updating your priors, and trust your gut when the screens turn red.
Catch you in the next one.
Goodbye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where our thoughts go from slow takes to facts on cue. We change and follow through my weird prompts. That's the close from sloth.